Who likes an ending? Who is it who I think people split into kind of two groups on this. That some people like kind of closure and an ending to things, and other people are kind of much more, I'd like to leave things open-ended, and kind of, I don't like the finality of kind of completely finishing something. Do you get me? Kind of some people like closure in the end, other people just like to leave things kind of open-ended. Who are the closure people? Who are the open-ended kind of, I'd like to leave hanging? Yeah, okay. I've realised I'm definitely a closure person. I kind of knew that about myself already. On Friday, there we go. Oh, yeah, the end. There we go. Bit of humour, if you missed it. On Friday, there were two ministers from the local area who were moving on, and some I've known better than others, but I was very keen. I thought Good Friday, they're both moving on quite soon. I thought may well be the last chance that I see them after we had the March of Witness. I was very keen. For me, it was a big thing to kind of just say, shake their hand and say goodbye, I pray God blesses you as you go into whatever's next. And for me, that was the kind of thing I wanted to have, a moment of kind of saying goodbye and thank you. I realised that was how much that meant something to me, that I like that kind of closure and ending something in a good way. Yeah, I may well bump into them again, but I like to have that point of just saying goodbye. I know for other people, some of you be happy just kind of leaving it open-ended and say, well, I might bump into them again at some point, who knows what will happen. But I'm a closure kind of person. And so I quite like the fact that having done this little journey that we've been on through Mark, 16 chapters of Mark. If you've not been here, we've been doing a chapter a week. We started all the way back in January. It's been 16 weeks between Christmas and Easter that we've been working our way through Mark. And I know I've been hearing from people that it's been quite enjoyable, quite nice to work through Mark in that way, working through a gospel in this way. I thought the videos might get really kind of dry, or kind of we might get a bit weary of them. And when I first watched the first one, I thought, oh, it's a bit, he's got a bit of a funny voice, and how's this going to go down? But I don't know about, what I've picked up from people is that we've kind of warmed to them more and more as we've gone on, and we're going to miss his voice and having them acted out for us. But it's been great, so I quite like the fact that I get to close it and finish it off. But also, this gives me a problem, because the ending of Mark does not give you closure. Oh, it's still going. The ending of Mark does not give you closure. This is the problem. If you've got one of the church Bibles open, you can see the problem. You see this whole chunk of it that is in italics. And verse 9 to 20, the last bit that we heard, is almost certainly not written by Mark, who wrote the gospel. It is almost certainly not written. It's almost certain that it was written by a scribe who at some point was copying it out. The dramatised version by the guy actually really helps with that, because you kind of notice that uncomfortable moment where he finished one bit and then he walked to the front, and suddenly, especially if you've watched the whole thing, it was in a very different style to the way he's been able to present the rest of the gospel to us. Suddenly he was stood at the front kind of talking at everybody as he finished, which hasn't really been the way of the way he's been doing it through that whole, the 16 weeks that we've been watching him. And that's part of the point, that suddenly at the end it sort of changes style. And the people who really look into the Greek and stuff go, that's really strange that he should suddenly change style at the end. Also, there's a really difficult connection. This is verse 8 and verse 9 here. There's a really difficult connection between them. At the start of the chapter, he introduces that it's Mary, and Salome going to the tomb. And yet suddenly in verse 9, we get that kind of bit we've just had summarised again, and we're reintroduced to Mary again, which seems a bit odd that you've just told us who Mary is and that Mary was there and that Mary went to the tomb, and now suddenly we're explaining who Mary is again, out of whom Jesus had drove seven demons. So it seems a really awkward connection to what's gone before. And so what it says here, the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 to 20. Those who can work out, we've got loads and loads, if you don't know how it's worked, we've got loads and loads of copies of handwritten out versions of the Gospels and other books from the New Testament, handwritten out in the Greek because you couldn't, print it back then. So it's all handwritten out. We've got hundreds and thousands of copies of it, and people who are really clever can work out which are the earliest ones and can look at how one's been copied from another. And it's clever little things, like if someone made a mistake in one, they can then see all the others who copy that same mistake and work out, well, that all came from that one. And it really works. There's a very clever science behind it. I had a lecturer at college, and one year, a bunch of students had done a spoof on the start of an essay, and they had all written the start of their essay with the same kind of spoof of the beginning of Luke. Luke's gospel begins, "Dear Theophilus," and has a whole little opening. And they'd all started their same essay with a "Dear Conrad." Conrad Gemp was the lecturer. "Dear Conrad," and started a whole spoof of the beginning of Luke at the start of their essay. And him, this lecturer, and another lecturer sat down, and they used these tools of, it's called textual criticism, to work out which students were the one who started it. Because different students, as they copied it, had either altered something or made little changes, like someone had dropped in, you know, "Conrad the righteous dude," or something like that. And so he can't have been the first one, because he's added that in to the other ones, and no one else has got that. And they used it, and they narrowed it down from a class of about 30 to 2 people who they worked out must have started it. And they were right. So the tools work. Anyway, the point is they can work out who's copied who and how it's gone back. And they can work out that the earliest copies that we've got don't have this ending. Don't have verses 9 to 20. So it's almost certain, for all those kind of reasons, that it wasn't part of what Mark wrote in the first place. So it gives me a problem as someone who liked closure. Because the other problem is that verse 8 is a really odd ending. If you're going to just end with verse 8, if that is where Mark ended, it's very strange. "Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid." And so we've got two theories of what's going on here. Is verse 8 the ending that Mark intended? Did he intend to leave us hanging like that and not conclude it? Leave us with those questions. Is he someone like those of you in the room who don't like closure, who want to leave it open-ended, who want to leave you going, "Well, what happened next? What did they go and do?" And want to leave you asking those questions and wanting to find out more and wanting to work out how you're going to respond to all that you've read through the Gospel of Mark. Or did something else happen? Did somehow the end of the scroll, the end of some of those very early copies of Mark, or Mark's very original, did somehow that get damaged? You know, we're talking about, you know, a big roll of paper here. This is how these things were. And like books today, I was actually meant to bring in one of my kids' books to go, "The last page is missing," because they things get damaged. Did something happen? Did it get damaged? Did a bit get missing? And there's kind of two theories as to what went on there. And to be honest, we're never going to quite know the answer. Either way, we don't have anything after verse 8 that we know was written by Mark. So either he decided to end it there, or we haven't got the next bit. There's nothing else that we can do about that. But actually what we do get from this ending, whether he ends at verse 8, and actually the other end, the extended ending we've got, it actually helps us to explore still some of the themes that come through Mark. And one of the things I love about this question, as we dig into it, is actually it's going to make us think, well, what is this ending all about? Because we've got these questions about it, it really makes us think, well, what was Mark meaning? If he was going to end at verse 8, what was he trying to do? What was he trying to get across to us? What's he want us to understand? And it makes us really kind of dig into it in a way we might not do otherwise. And one of the things that we've seen running through Mark, and if you were here on Thursday evening for the Maundy Thursday communion, is this question about belief and unbelief. And whatever ending actually we go for in Mark, we see that question raised for us again. So we see the women, they come to the tomb, they hear the good news announced to them that Jesus has risen from the dead, he's been crucified and he has risen. And their response that we get in verse 8, of course, is trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone. You know, sometimes, particularly at Christmas, we like to do the little kind of play in some way around. We kind of think about, oh, what was it like for the angel Gabriel when God said, "I'm choosing you to be the one to go and announce," or the angels going to the shepherds, "I'm choosing you guys to go and announce to the shepherds this great news that a saviour has been born, and they're going to go off and they're going to go and meet him." I wonder what it was like for, and we're just told a man in Mark, but the others tell us angels specifically. For the angel here, who goes to the tomb and goes to announce to these Marys that Jesus, he's been crucified and he's risen. And they run off trembling and bewildered and saying nothing to anyone. In my head, this angel was very excited having been given this commission and then kind of sits there dejected, kind of, "No, you didn't get what I meant. Oh, did I say something wrong?" It's not quite the response that you're looking for, is it? It's not kind of the response that you hope for. And we come face to face with the realism that Mark's given us throughout his gospel. The reality of what he's presented us. Again and again, he's presented us with humanity. with the frailness of humanity on display. What we get in the Gospels are not heroes, but humans. Real people with this mixture of belief and unbelief, of doubts, of missing the point, of not quite getting it. It didn't come easy for them. And sometimes we kind of think, oh, if only we were there, if we were there and we saw the empty tomb, then it'd be so much easier for me to believe. It wasn't easy for them, trembling and bewildered. What is going on? Sometimes the proof that we might wish that we had wouldn't actually make things any easier for us. So if verse 8 is the end, if this is what we get for the end of the gospel, then actually, as we saw on Thursday night, if you were here and one of the videos kind of highlighted it for us, saying, well, what we get throughout the whole Gospel of Mark is this picture again and again of kind of an unsatisfactory response to Jesus. We've got the Pharisees and the scribes and all that. They've been kind of having this really negative response to Jesus. Well, basically, we see this journey of them responding badly, questioning him, and ultimately setting out to have Jesus arrested and killed. Or we see the response of the crowds who are amazed by what Jesus has done, who come and follow him and are looking for the next miracle, but their response is nothing more than that. There's awe and wonder, but nothing further. They don't begin to follow him. They don't believe who he really is. And then we get the disciples, who again and again we see Jesus explaining to them what's going on, what he's going to do, but they're just in confusion, bewildered, doubting, questioning. And if this is where Mark ends the gospel, then he leads us with this hanging thing of saying, well, these responses aren't enough, are they? They're not right. They're not satisfactory. So, well, what is the right response? And what will your response be? How will we respond? And how do we carry on the story from there? And there's been hints already through the gospel, even just a couple of verses, the verse before, but go tell his disciples and Peter. That actually there's already this hint just in the verse before that something of the response that God is looking for, that Jesus is looking for, is to go and to tell. In fact, even earlier in the gospel, which makes me wonder if Mark did intend for us to have more, this is chapter 9, verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, that's after the transfiguration, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. He was already pointing them and us to the fact that after his resurrection, the secret was to be out. They were to go and tell people about what had happened. They were to go and tell others about him. And where we take verse 9 to 20, whoever it's written by, it actually carries on this kind of theme of belief and unbelief. It's a good ending, although there's one or two bits that might be questionable. We can carry on this theme. Verse 9, when they'd heard that Jesus was alive, that she had seen him, they did not believe it. And then this is one of the other reasons that we kind of think it's a bit of an add-on, because it feels like a bit of a summary of other Gospels, some of the other things. So this is the, and then we get a kind of a summary of the road to Emmaus. Jesus appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking in the country. They did not believe them either. When they come back from the road to Emmaus, the others didn't believe them. And then we get Jesus coming and rebuking them for not believing and saying, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved. Whoever does not believe will be condemned. Interestingly, if this is a kind of a slightly later, maybe within the first couple of hundred years, it gives us a picture of what was important to the early church. And clearly part of what was important to them was belief and being baptized. And we carry on. And what Jesus says further, and these signs will accompany those who believe. One of the things that seems quite strange about this is where it talks here about picking up snakes with their hands and when they drink deadly poison, it won't hurt them, which seems really odd and not kind of, you know, if you're familiar with the Bible, if you've read a lot, you think that doesn't quite fit with other things that we've kind of heard Jesus say. And I want to kind of make the point saying, if you think that actually then a way of kind of testing your belief is to go and drink deadly poison, you're definitely falling into one of the traps that Jesus was presented with when he was tempted. Throw yourself off this building and ask God to catch you. If you've got that kind of faith, then you don't need to prove the point. Anyway, but as I say, it's probably not in what Mark wrote in the first place. So we get this picture again, even in the ending that we have got, of belief and unbelief. There's this invitation to believe. With this extended ending, we get this invitation to come and to believe in Jesus, to draw your conclusion of faith. But rather than looking at what we kind of question, let's come back to what is in any way the climax of Mark's gospel, verse 6 and 7. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Let's spend a few minutes thinking about kind of this, what the whole gospel, this last 16 weeks, has been pointing us towards Jesus, the one who would come. And he begins by saying, "You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene." And it's a reminder there, actually, of where we began. Jesus, born human. This is Jesus the Nazarene. This is someone who's fully human, who's come and done this. Begins by reminding us something of his humanity. And we get this contrast, who was crucified, who died, who was crucified, and you know that he is dead, yet he is risen. Jesus didn't come to wow people with signs and with miracles. But as we saw right from the start of the gospel, Jesus came to serve, to be the one who is the suffering servant who would redeem the world through his death. And it's been the destiny of the gospel from the outset. Again, if you were here Thursday night, John helped us pick up on that. All the way through Mark, seeing these little pointers. He chose the disciples, he included Judas who would betray him. So he sets out on this way towards the cross. And again, these little pointers that where we were going is that Jesus would die. And again, these little pointers where Jesus points to his death and says, "But I'll rise again. The Son of Man will rise again." These little pointers as to what's going to happen. This is where we're going. And it gives us, too, our model for discipleship, for what it means to follow Jesus. Jesus has given us that model, for what it means to obediently serve him. Back in chapter 8, this is from around verse 35, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me." He's already called us to follow in his footsteps. He's now shown us the way, modelled it in going to death on the cross. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. He's pointed us towards what it means to follow, to take up our cross and follow him. The daily joy is found in faithful service, in following him. He's given us the example in himself and called us to follow. Coming back to verse 7, and we get another contrast, not just he was crucified and he's risen, but he's not here, he's going ahead of you. The call at this point for the disciples was to act in faith. There's an interesting thing that Jesus here doesn't appear to them at the tomb. Jesus isn't there. You know, in some ways you think it might be easier and more convenient, and maybe they'd be less bewildered and confused if, well, Jesus could have been there. Couldn't he? He seems to appear where he wants to right now at this point, so Jesus could have been there. But even at this point, he calls them to act in faith. They have to listen to this word, and they have to go and meet him back in Galilee. They've got to travel back from Jerusalem to Galilee. Yeah, it was Galilee. Now, in fact, from Jerusalem back to Galilee to go and meet him there. They still have to act in faith. There's still this call for them to believe the word, to believe, to click on to something of what Jesus has said, to remember the words that he talked to them about, that he would rise again, and to trust that that is what really has happened. And the call for them and for us is to trust that he goes ahead of us, that he continues to go ahead of us now, that he continues to call us to follow him, and that he is there ahead of us. And ultimately, what we see through Easter, the hope that we have through Easter, is to trust that he has even gone ahead of us into death itself, that he's even gone ahead of us through death and showed us that it's not the end. Sometimes we have this kind of thing that we think as Christians, because of Easter, there's no fear of death anymore or anything like that. Death strikes me still as an enemy. Sin and death entered the world. I'm not sure death is a good thing. But what we're showing through Jesus is that he's gone ahead of us and shown us that it's not the end. That we have to trust him, that even facing death, it's not the end, and he goes ahead of us. This is where the gospel has pointed us to walk and follow Jesus. So as we look at the conclusion of the gospel, what's your conclusion? We've made this journey from Christmas through to Easter. We've seen Jesus from born in a place where they kept animals to dying on a cross and rising again. And how will you respond? The question that we're given somewhere in here is saying, is our response satisfactory? Have we had a negative response? Have we just been in awe and amazement like the crowds, but not believed? Are we left confused and wondering? Or have we made a decision to believe? A decision to follow Jesus, to believe in the gospel that we've been shown in Mark, to believe in Jesus who we've been shown in Mark, that he is the one who's the servant who's come to save. That he was fully human and fully God. That he's our Lord and worthy to be our King. Have we met him as our risen Lord? And if we have, where is he now going ahead of us? What's the journey that he's calling us on? Where is it that he's now telling us, go, go here, do this, trust me for that? What is it he's calling us to do? The place, the things that he says today, I'm going ahead of you, and I want you to trust me and to follow me. We get this ending here in the bit that's added on to Mark 16, to go and to preach the gospel to all creation. It's the right conclusion to Mark, that the call is to believe and to go and to share it with others, to be the one who will serve others and speak Jesus to them. How's Jesus calling us to go and do that today? How's he calling us to go and to take that gospel today to others? And actually, that's where we're going next. Next week, we start on Galatians. And so if you want to get ahead, you can begin reading Galatians in the first section of that. And Galatians has a whole load of it about what the gospel is, what it means to follow, and how we share that gospel with others. And that's what we'll be looking at over the coming weeks, as we seek to believe, to follow Jesus, and to be a people who live to proclaim the Jesus that we've seen over the last 16 weeks. The Jesus who came, who served, who suffered, who rose again, and is our Saviour. So what's your conclusion? How do you live your conclusion to Mark and to the Jesus we've discovered?